Thank you, David. Okay, like David said, my name's Laura. I've been a member of CISPUS for about a year and was down on the delegation from June 20th to June 30th. So this is sort of my report back on the delegation to let you know what we found out. Keep it kind of informal, and we can have a discussion when it's over about some of the stuff that comes up. I brought some pictures that are on this laptop, so I'll show that. You can pass it around if people need to see more. So, you know, Dave gave you a bit of a historical context of El Salvador, just some current contextual information about the state in El Salvador that I think is really important to have in hand is, you know, El Salvador is currently in dire economic straits. CAFTA and other neoliberal policies are, you know, steadily worsening the quality of life of the poor majority of the population and making the rich minority a lot wealthier. And one way that you saw this a lot, just in terms of the economic situation there, was the street vendors and the informal sector. The growth of the informal sector there has been huge in the past years. And everyone is a street vendor. You know, there's people of all ages, all, you know, both genders. Like, there's so many street vendors, young children. A lot of the teachers we spoke with said that, you know, that form of kind of child labor is something that they're, you know, starting to get really concerned about. And so that's, you know, one thing that stood out really starkly that I wanted to make sure to mention. Basically, we're seeing all around rising prices, privatization of social services, and that type of thing. Really great examples of the U.S.'s stranglehold on El Salvador are the, you know, dollarization. When I first started learning about El Salvador, that totally, you know, they used the dollar, you know, blew my mind. A lot of you who know more about the situation are already aware of that. They have troops in Iraq. They're, I believe, the only Latin American country with troops in Iraq. And then the U.S. embassy there, which we visited, is a fortress. And, you know, not sarcastically, it's absurdly huge. And you have to go through two levels of security to get in. And it's the largest U.S. embassy in Central America, in El Salvador, which is the size of Massachusetts. And along with, you know, all of the economic stuff I was talking about, we're also seeing a huge rise in political repression in recent years. Things like the anti-terrorism law, which were passed, which was a law that was helped push through the Salvadoran legislature by the Bush administration. And it's been used against social movement leaders, peaceful organizers. The Suchitoto 13 is a really famous case of that, which I'll talk about in a second. There's been reports from the former human rights ombudswoman, as well as the Catholic Archdiocese, that the state of human rights is just, you know, rolling back from since the peace accords were signed. Death squads are reemerging. There's a lot of political assassinations, especially leading up to the upcoming elections. 23 FMLN and social movement leaders have been killed since March of 2006. Another side of that huge problem is, you know, total impunity is given to these cases, and little to no investigation is done. The people who committed the assassinations aren't, you know, being prosecuted at all. And that brings us, you know, to what this delegation was all about, which was the upcoming elections. And we went as a fact-finding delegation to learn more about the situation there leading up to those elections and whether there is a place right now for free and fair elections in El Salvador, whether that is a possibility, because it's really exciting elections coming up. So the delegation, we were 17 people, and we're pretty much all ethnicities, classes, from all over the U.S. There were a few other organizations other than CISPUS represented, but primarily CISPUS. I was the, as Dave said, the only Boston delegate there. And you know, we were students, teachers, professors, journalists, union organizers, professionals, activists, all types of stuff. And it was really wide variety of people, which was nice to see. Some Salvadoran Americans, some not Salvadoran Americans, all that type of thing. And we had some four specific goals for the delegation. And the first was to meet with and show solidarity to our allies as they fight water privatization, the effects of CAFTA, and government repression, and to also support them in their work towards change in the upcoming elections. Our second goal was to meet with human rights offices and other institutions that have worked to denounce political violence and repression. And this is actually a photograph of all of us at the Human Rights Ombudsman office, where we met with him to go over some of the concerns that we had gotten as we did our fact-finding. And then the final... and then the third objective was to produce a report about human rights abuses, government repression, and potential irregularities leading up to the elections. This is a photograph. That report's going to be coming out in the next couple weeks, most likely. And we're hoping to use that for congressional visits, to get out to the media, to really give people the facts and the nitty-gritty to pick up the story and get the word out about what's going on. And you'll soon find out why. The final goal was to generate media both in the U.S. and El Salvador, which we've already started on, and, you know, we're really hoping to get the word out to Congress as well as the media about this. And then most importantly, just to be there as witnesses to what's going on and bring that information back to the United States and share it with people. And what we saw, it was my first time in El Salvador. It was a really intense trip for me. Everything we saw, I think that it really kind of solidified in my mind a lot of the political analysis and that I've been doing over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years. And it was a really amazing trip. And first, I'm going to talk about repression and what we heard about government repression there and what's going on with that. And I think the first thing that I've told, you know, all my friends since coming back that surprises everyone is there were the security precautions for us as a delegation were, you know, extremely high just because there is that state of fear there. It wasn't so much about our safety as it was about us endangering, you know, Salvadorans that are staying in the country, but we, you know, couldn't leave the group at all, or you couldn't wear any political clothing or hats or anything. There was absolutely no discussion of, you know, any of our meetings or politics in public. We even had, you know, a code word in case someone started to, you know, talk at a restaurant to get them to stop. It's really, and all of these security guidelines were given to us by social movement leaders there. These were their recommendations. They're, you know, it is a complete state of fear there. People are really worried about being targeted because of their politics. And one of, you know, a huge example of that happened was the Suchitoto 13 arrests. So this was an incident, it was almost exactly a year ago, when 13... peaceful demonstrators were arrested. They were at a demonstration protesting water privatization, and they were arrested, tortured, and charged under the anti-terrorism law that I was telling you about that was pushed through by the Bush administration. That law holds 40 to 60 year sentences. You know, these people were not committing terrorist acts by any means. In fact, quite a few of them were arrested on their way to the demonstrations. And so we met with Vicente and Beatriz, who are two individuals that were members of the Suchitoto 13 that were arrested. And this is Vicente and Beatriz too. And they were two people who were arrested on the way to the demonstration. So they hadn't even made it there. And they told us about their experience. And I wanted to share that with you. They were traveling as representatives of a nearby FMLN municipality to participate in the demonstration, and they were handcuffed first and then pepper sprayed. Vicente was beaten in front of Beatriz. You know, it's pretty horrific stories that they're sharing with us about, you know, what they witnessed and what happened to them and their friends. And the level of torture that they described was sick. And one thing that Beatrice said is it was clear that the people, the police were trained in torture. They weren't just beating them up. They were trained in torture. And after they were arrested, they were put into a helicopter. And Beatrice told a lot of this testimony about the arrest, and it was very intense and difficult to hear, but also really inspiring to talk to these people who survived that experience. And they were put into a helicopter when they were taken from Suchitoto. Next to Suchitoto is a really big lake, and they were told that they were going to be dropped in the lake. They were basically told from the beginning that they were going to be killed. And they were told that they were going to be dropped in the lake. Then later, after they got out of the helicopter, they were lined up execution style, with rifles pointed at them, completely, you know, humiliated and treated, not allowed. After they were detained, they weren't allowed any medical attention for the, you know, these wounds that they were suffering from torture that they received. One of the compañeros that was arrested was beaten so badly he's got permanent inner ear damage now, and, you know, it's going to have vertigo the rest of his life. Just really horrific stories that I was hearing here and were aware of it, but to see this human face on it is a really stark thing, and to talk to these people and watch them, you know, describe through tears what they went through. Another thing that Beatrice talked a lot about was the conditions of the prisons that they were kept in, and that was kind of a really hard part to hear. These prisons in El Salvador are in a horrible state, and 90 people were in one cell. There was no room for beds, barely enough room to sit down or lay down on the floor. The hardest thing to hear was she talked about children at the women's prison. The children are kept in a facility next door, and the mothers can hear the screams of their children. Many of them are sexually abused at that facility, and it's right next to the women's prison. These women are listening to their children. Vicente pointed out that a lot of the prisoners there have been held for, you know, 10 years plus and haven't even been charged with crimes yet. And, you know, so that was the conditions that these people who were arrested for nothing more than, you know, intending to go to a demonstration were put in. And it was really, a lot of international outcry came out of this, despite, you know, the fact that there wasn't much press coverage here, and organizations like CSPIS and other solidarity groups really organized, tried to get the word out. There was a national week of action in the U.S. that CSPIS sponsored. We had events here in Boston that I went to, and and they were eventually released, and then after an entire year, the charges were dropped after a lengthy trial. And Vicente really said that he knew that it wasn't, if it hadn't been for the international pressure, that they'd probably, you know, be facing the sentences that they were being charged with. And so the charges were dropped, but that it's still, problems from this have continued, including Hector, who was the youngest of the people arrested, who's 20 years old. He was murdered recently. He had been speaking out about the situation, and there was no investigation was conducted, and so that was what we heard a lot about from them. And I think what was most troubling for me about this was also just knowing the role that the U.S. plays in that, and some really the U.S. encouraged the anti-terrorism law to be passed. And this is the law that was used to justify their arrests and torture. It's based on the Patriot Act that we know so well. Our tax dollars are going into things like Plan Merida, which is used to pay and train police officers, the same police officers that are committing these acts. The ILEA, which is the International Law Enforcement Academy, that is funded by U.S. tax dollars and operated by the U.S. in El Salvador, also trains these police officers that are committing these acts. And we continue to support the Arena government through money that we give through the Millennium Fund, and they continue to offer impunity to actions like this and accept them because they're keeping down, you know, they think that they it, this is how to keep down the opposition. And to know, you know, how the role that the U.S. is playing in the story that these people were telling me was, it's something I know, but to have that in my head while I'm listening to these stories was, that was really tough and intense to hear. Like I said, they really also talked about what international solidarity meant to them. And so that's kind of a little eye on the repression that we're seeing there. We heard lots of stories also, in addition to this, about murders and, you know, arrests and abuses that are just not being investigated at all. That seems to be, you know, the huge, one of the biggest issues right there is the police are just aren't investigating any of the politically motivated crimes that are being committed. So with that climate of an, you know, of the economic situation, this political repression on top of that, we've got the elections coming up in 2009, and this is a huge moment of hope in El Salvador, and we there are a lot of obstacles though towards free and fair elections, and they are offering that amazing, you know, sign of hope for real change and you know, adjust changes to the economic situation, changes to the justice system, and adjust El Salvador, but there are a lot of obstacles to them. We got to meet with Norma Guevara, who's a historic FMLN leader, and she's also the expert in the party on the electoral process. Violeta Menjivar, who is the FMLN mayor of San Salvador, and who came in to say hi to us at the meeting. This is Norma, and that's Violeta. There's a painting of Violeta right behind her. So we met with her, and she really went over like some of the stuff, the concerns that the FMLN has about the electoral process coming up. The some of those included the 56 recommendations that were made by the Organization of American States, which the U.S. is a member of, on ways that the electoral process needs to be reformed before the elections. And almost none of these recommendations are being followed. The biggest concern that we heard, not only from Norma, but also from groups like Acción Ciudadana, which is the citizen action group, which organizes around elections and the electoral process. One of their huge concerns is the state of the padrones, which are the voter rolls. And just a stat that they gave us is that there are 109,707 bad entries in them, where it's either a duplicate or the, you know, data doesn't match the ID data, and there's a problem with the entry, and it lends the possibility of, you know, voting twice, you know, people voting for dead people, people being not allowed to vote, all that type of thing. And and just so that's 109,707 bad entries. And just to give you an idea, in the last elections, San Salvador, the city of San Salvador, was won by just 40 votes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in on that scale, it's huge to have that many irregularities. The TSE is the Supreme Electoral Tribunal that is supposed to be a political group, but they are extremely politicized right now. The legislature appoints the members of that organization, and the FMLN has very little representation on in the tribunal. Only one FMLN member has been allowed to see the padrones, and Norma was telling us how he had to sneak a cell phone in so he could snap photos of it, because they're not allowing these records to get out. They're not, you know, allowing the changes to be made so that the elections can be accurate. And the TSC has also been reforming electoral laws. They've now made it so, used to be that a member of each party had to sign off on every vote to guarantee its legitimacy when you cast your ballot, and they took away that rule, which lends the possibility for ballot stuffing, all of that type of stuff. And then there's also been threats to not allow international observers into the country, which, you know, I don't think it's going to happen, because I think most people are aware that, you know, international observance is kind of legitimizes elections, and but that has been something that the TSC and also Tony Saka have said that they want to limit international observance of the election. The other huge part that I think is really important to all of us living in the United States is the role that U.S. intervention is going to play in these elections. And so, first of all, we heard a lot about from people there about the intervention of 2004 in the presidential elections then. People talked about statements that were made by the former ambassador, as well as members of the State Department here in the U.S. They were basically saying that if the FMLN was elected, the U.S. would not maintain a favorable relationship with El Salvador. And one woman we spoke with, who's she's a union organizer working with the maquilas, the sweatshops there, she said that they were specifically told during the last elections, you know, their bosses came up to them, this intense propaganda, that, you know, oh, well, if you vote for the FMLN, they use the term, I'm trying to remember what I think, it's a term that means whitey, and now I'm not going to be able to remember, but whitey's not going to like that, and not going to bring business here, and y'all will be out of jobs. So this information was definitely, you know, coming out. The press is dominated by the right wing in El Salvador, so all these reports were coming out that, you know, the U.S. wasn't, you know, was going to cut off their friendly relations with El Salvador should the FMLN be elected. And then the one that we heard the most talk about, which I'm sure some of you have heard about, was the Republican representative from Ohio, Tom Tancredo, made statements.
From Colorado?
Okay, I'm sorry. I wrote it down wrong. His statements about remittances. And he made claims that there was legislation that would be passed that would mean that remittances would no longer be allowed to be sent home from the U.S. to El Salvador. It's a pretty absurd threat. There's not really any way to enforce it. And there really was no way that something like that would pass through the legislature. But his statement, he wasn't expecting, you know, the law to be passed. He was just hoping that those words would get out to the Salvadoran people and change their mind. Remittances are huge in El Salvador. The money sent home from the U.S. makes up the largest portion of the of income in the country. Their economy is sustained by remittances. So that statement alone was, you know, everyone I spoke with there believed was the deciding factor in the elections. And so one of the things that we did while that we were there was we met with the current U.S. ambassador to El Salvador, who is Charles Glazer. And that was a really troubling experience. We originally were given a meeting with a labor attaché, and she kind of was very diplomatic and said, you know, she was going to look into everything that we said. And then at the last minute, Charles Glazer came in to say hi to us and immediately went in to abusive mode and was just speaking down to everyone, interrupting people mid-sentence, standing over people, yelling at them. Wouldn't let us get a single, you know, word out, basically accused us all of being, you know, just a bunch of lefties, and made, you know, statement, you know, this was just incredibly rude, not interested in hearing what we had to say at all. And one of the delegates actually called him out, so we got him to shut up for 10 minutes while we just spoke to him, which felt like a bit of a victory that we were able to get that out there. But one of the statements that he made during the meeting was that he said, did the U.S. intervene in 2004? Yes. And we believe this is the first time that a member of the Bush administration has admitted to that. So that's pretty huge. He then went on to say, will we intervene this year? No. Or this time, no. And, you know, is that actually, is it an empty promise or not? Probably so. But just that admission from him was pretty amazing.
Did he say it was an empty promise?
No, he didn't say it was an empty promise. He said, did we intervene in 2004? Yes. Will we intervene this year? No. And so that really brings us to the intervention we're already seeing. And that's the reason it's an empty promise, is because while we were there, Glaser was already making interventionist statements about the election. He's been saying a lot of stuff about the U.S. would never have friendly relations with a government that has connections to the FARC. And the FMLN doesn't have connections to the FARC, but the implication is clear. And it's playing in with the dirty campaign that Arena is conducting that, you know, is making those ties between the FMLN and the FARC, which we saw a lot of while we were there, and especially also trying to make this connection between the FMLN and you know, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And there's posters plastered everywhere that are put up by right-wing groups, but they're made to look like FMLN campaign posters. And they've got, you know, a picture of Mauricio Funes, the presidential candidate, with his arm around Hugo Chavez that's clearly photoshopped. And, you know, and it says, like, socialism or death at, you know, a Chavista El Salvador. And these are posters that are being put up by right-wing groups. So the point we really tried to make to Glaser is that just saying, oh, well, I'm not going to mention the party names doesn't mean it's not intervention. You need to be extremely careful about the things you say, because you know as well as the rest of us that press here is right-wing and is going to report things in a certain way. And another example of comments he was making, this happened also while we were there, there was this group of right-wing editorialists held a press conference and said, you know, we're really concerned that if the FMLN is elected, freedom of the press will be done away with. And Glaser sat next to them and said, you know, the U.S. would never support a government that doesn't support freedom of the press. But he doesn't say the FMLN, so he says that, you know, he has no control over what the press says, and, you know, the press is free, and, you know, and then would yell, do you believe in the First Amendment at us? And that was kind of how the discussion with him was going. Another really troubling thing that got brought up by Jamie when we were just talking to her, she's the labor attaché, about the involvement that the NED is going to have in the upcoming elections, which is the National Endowment for Democracy. She talked about the IRI and the NDI, which are sort of the Republican and Democratic, respectively, party subsets within the NED, and that they're going to be conducting, she told us that we should be less concerned about fraud in the elections because these two groups would be conducting a quick count of the elections. And as I'm sure many of you know, the NED has been, you know, repeatedly implicated in intervening in Latin American elections and politics. And the thought that, you know, them conducting a quick count is supposed to legitimize this legislation just seemed absurd. On top of that, the IRI actually presented a peace award to Tony Saca, who's the current president, part of the Arena Party, you know, demonstrating clearly that they have an ideological, you know, stance on this. And when we brought that up to Jamie, she immediately kind of started backpedaling and admitted, you know, that they're controversial organizations. And then she said, oh, well, they're not so much going to be they're just going to be helping the Salvadorans to conduct their elections. And that was really troubling, and that's one thing that we've written press releases about, and we're really trying to get the word out there so we can get denouncements of the involvement of the NED in that election, in the upcoming elections. So that is the backdrop for the upcoming elections, you know, in terms of internal fraud as well as U.S. intervention. And on top of that, interesting thing, you know, a good thing to know is that the FMLN has a 21-point lead despite this dirty campaign that is being conducted against them and all the stuff. And that's what's, you know, I think is getting everyone so excited, and why so many of us are so excited about this time in El Salvador, because there really is potential for, you know, a regime change there, basically. And there really is this opportunity for, you know, wonderful things to happen. And we want to see the Salvadoran people be self-determinant and make that decision. And that's, you know, the reason why so this is important to me. I think it's important to a lot of people here. I think a lot of you know this, and I kind of have this in here. I was going to give a little bit of information about the FMLN, and part of this was, I think that a lot of you already know, but basically they are a, as David was saying, they're a revolutionary leftist party, and they were the former guerrillas that took up arms during the Civil War. They're formed out of the four kind of main guerrilla groups. And then when the peace accords were signed in 1992, they were recognized as a formal political party in El Salvador. They have participated in 8 presidential elections, but, you know, fraud and intimidation and all of that has kept them from winning those elections. They've still continued to organize and to build their movement. They have gained substantial amounts of seats in the legislature. They serve as municipal governments of quite a few of the municipalities there, which we had the pleasure of visiting, you know, and they really are a party that represents and serves the Salvadoran people. They're committed to a self-determinant nation and with a government that is represented by the masses and by the people of El Salvador. And now they have a 21-point lead, so we can all become very excited now. And, so I think that there really is, you know, despite all of these, the situation there and what's going on and the economic, the state of the economy there, the living conditions, the political repression, there's an opportunity to put that into Salvadoran history and start moving on into really developing their nation as a self-determinant nation. And then, you know, a little bit of information about ARENA. They were founded by the orchestrator of many death squads, as David was saying. They represent the oligarchy and the 12 families that control all of the capital in El Salvador. And they don't respect the peace accords. They are the, you know, government that's standing idly by while human rights abuses are carried out. And so all of that is also occurring in, you know, the context of this leftward tide that we're seeing in Latin America right now, as, you know, government after government in Latin America is going left. 2009 could be the year for a democratic revolution in El Salvador. And what, you know, what would that look like? What would an FMLN run El Salvador look like? We visited a few FMLN municipalities, and one of the ones we went to was Mexicanos, which is a suburb of San Salvador, and we got to see a lot of stuff there that was really amazing, and, you know, it would be great to even see just here in the U.S., but they've got clinics that are, you know, $2 a visit that are open to the entire community, where medicine is free, that they're organizing without federal funds. Here's a photograph of one of the clinics. They are also, you know, these clinics also go out and do public health initiatives. to for preventative to you know for preventative care for the community. We also visited a youth center, which is one of the places that CSPA supports with our material aid docket. They're, you know, addressing the huge problem of crime and gangs in El Salvador. This is a guitar class at the youth center. They've got guitar classes, ping pong, computer classes, soccer, you know, training, all kinds of stuff that is open to, you know, all these kids for extremely low cost that's actually affordable. And they've turned an area that was, you know, really dangerous into this beautiful youth center. It's also a political institution. It's not just this youth center. It's these kids here. This is a karate class taking place in front of a poster that says "Felicidades, Comandante," congratulations, Comandante, and has pictures of Che Guevara all over it. So it is, you know, soccer practice takes place in front of a mural of Farabundo Martí, and it's a political institution. It is there to, you know, not only give kids a place to be and something to do, but also to help them with their political education. Another really awesome thing to see is how organized the social movement in El Salvador is. We, just some examples, we met with the FURD, which is the Roque Dalton University Front. It's a university group that, a revolutionary university group. Just walking around the campus, you see like posters and flyers, and every organization has the word Frente in it. Like, seeing how politicized the universities are there was, you know, amazing, and how organized and all these events they're holding, all that kind of stuff. The FURD works to educate the student body and give them a political analysis. They organize students around community struggles, as well as issues that are really pertinent to them, like bus fare and campus issues. They're also helping to make sure that the university remains a bastion of progressive thought, and that was really amazing to see, because having gone to university here in the U.S., it's a pretty sad comparison in terms of, you know, how politicized campuses are. Another opportunity we had was we got to go CETA, which is the water workers union. Organizes these community forums where they travel all over El Salvador to provide education on water privatization, what that would mean to the majority of Salvadorans, you know, that it would basically mean less access to water and higher prices. They are going, you know, from town to town, just meeting with these people, having these discussions, and... Oh, here's some of the university students. And they're... So the CETA is... We got to go to one of those forums, and the, you know, people are coming out. The community's coming out. They're going to these things. They're getting excited about it. They want to get involved in the movement. Like, the way that, you know, they're able to organize people there is amazing, and the power and unity of the social movement was, you know, awesome. This is one of the water workers talking to one of the delegates. So it's these members of the union that are actually going out to educate people on the damaging effects of privatization. And they are using, like, popular education techniques to, you know, put it into a political context and put it into, you know, the greater context, not just say water privatization is bad, but really work on bringing people who are concerned about having to pay more for water into the social movement and into the organized people. They are a huge part of that popular movement that is demanding change for their country. And there's, you know, organizations like this all over. There's the unions are incredibly active when it comes to the, you know, the opposition movement there. There's not Yes, we met with the Frente Sindical Salvadoreño, which is the Salvadoran Union Front, and, you know, the passion of every organizer is palpable, and you can see how, also, and that is where you are seeing the excitement about the upcoming elections when you're talking to these people that are anticipating finally a chance for our voices to be part of, you know, decision making for our, you know, for real change to be possible for the government to represent the people. So, as I said, the FMLN, you know, so that is what gives me hope about the situation there and what I think is really amazing. And with the FMLN, with their 21-point lead, if free and fair elections, you know, Lorena Peña, an FMLN leader, said to us, if free and fair elections were conducted today, we know that we would win. And then El Salvador could join the other Latin American countries that are battling transnationals and the oligarchy and battling them for the needs and rights of their people. It's happening all across Latin America, and I think El Salvador is on the verge of joining that movement in Latin America. So maybe now you're all wondering, hopefully I've gotten you all excited about this, what can you do? There, you know, one thing that Salvadorans that we met with were consistently telling us is that we need to be spreading the word about the situation up here. We need to be keeping an international eye on what's going on, that's the way we can most help. And some things that CISPAS is doing around that is we're doing these congressional visits. We're organizing a coalition on a local level, and there's also a national coalition of organizations supporting free and fair elections in El Salvador. We're getting Congress people to sign on and to letters committing that they will denounce intervention when it occurs. We're also, part of that is also grassroots education, reaching out to the public, just getting more and more people aware of the situation there. And that was the thing that I think everyone we spoke to when we asked, you know, what can we do? It's just bring the story up there. If we can get more of the international eye on it, that's going to make a huge difference. The next thing that they said was come as election observers. They need election observers down there. CISPAS is sending a delegation down for the January as well as March elections, because the legislative and municipal elections are in January, and then the presidential are in March. You know, all of you should go. we really want to be able to get an observer at every polling place. So the more people that can go, the better. That is a crucial part of free and fair elections, is international observance. So going on one of those delegations is a way you can get involved. And oppose U.S. intervention in the elections. You know, join the organizing that CISPAS does year-round to oppose U.S. intervention in El Salvador. And, you know, work with us on congressional visits, media outreach, anything you can offer, if it's calling people to get them out to events, showing up at events, giving your support, all of those are things that you can do and join our organizing effort. So that is what I saw while I was in El Salvador. That is why I'm excited about 2009 in El Salvador, and why I'm involved, why, you know, I'm going on these congressional meetings, why I'm going to the coalition meetings, and why I think that that more people should get involved and join that movement and that struggle and that international solidarity here in the U.S. And I think David...
So excited that you didn't tell people how to get involved.
Oh.
I think the best way tonight that you could find out how to get involved is to talk to me or Laura, or Shane, raise your hand. There he is. We're all members of CISPAS here in Boston. We also have sign-up sheets to give us your information so we can let you know what's going on. And I want to tell everybody about one more way to make a contribution, and then we'll have time for questions and comments and discussion. But one more way to make a contribution is to make a contribution.